Okay.
Is it working?
Yes. So, all right. So, this is the second Dr. Hairy podcast.
Yeah.
And in these podcasts, I'm Julian Lasso.
And I'm not Julian
Lasso. Yes. And I will be discussing a variety of research articles from the BJGP and the BMJ with my esteemed friend and colleague, Dr. David Hindmarsh.
That's me.
Here he is.
Can you remind me of my name later on?
Yes. Okay. So we're going to start off with one from the BJGP, which is one about...
planetary health,
isn't it? Which is called Planetary Health and Primary Care, What's the Emergency? And this comes from the November 2019 edition of the BJGP. So,
page 536.
Okay. All right. So... off you go.
Oh, right, you want me to shoot it?
Yeah, well, yeah. You've got the notes.
I'll just put my glasses on then. There's quite a lot in this article, but they're saying this is the, you know, planetary health is the greatest failure of humankind. I think the bloke who wrote this had quite some, you know, he knew quite a lot of long words.
He talks about... Because you couldn't understand.
Well, no, he talks about profligacy.
Profligacy.
Yes. Profiteering and politics, poison to the planet.
So he never got any further than the letter P in his dictionary.
Yes, he does like everything to start with the same letter. Anyway, he says we've littered the planet. And then he says something about Anthropocene epoch.
Anthropocene. That's what they're calling the current epoch, because it's dominated by the effects of humanity.
So that's
what Anthropocene means.
Oh, right, okay.
As in anthropomorphism, when you give things human characteristics.
Right, and, yes.
Anthropology, the study of human society.
Okay. The other thing he says is that we're fast improving healthcare. That's open to debate, I suppose.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we're fast worsening the planet's health.
Mm.
And he links the two, saying that, you know, all the things, that, you know, the bad effects of climate change, the geochemical cycles, land use, land cover, fresh water and arable land.
Yeah.
And is it too late?
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, you always wonder about things like this.
Yes.
You know, what's it got to do with medicine?
Yes.
I think there definitely is a link between, environmentalism and medicine. And if you look at what's happening in Australia at the moment,
yes.
Because, you know, Australia, as we speak, is hitting record high temperatures. Have you seen all this?
No.
They're breaking sort of, I think it's in the Adelaide area, but they're breaking at 46 degrees centigrade, which is really, really hot.
Yes, yeah.
Of course, there are immense bushfires in Australia.
That
is having an effect on people's health. So,
yes, of course.
People can't go outside because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And also because lots of the air is full of fumes in lots of areas.
Yes, yeah.
So, and we're looking at a possible future of things like crop failures and you know, you could see things like malaria coming into Europe.
That's exactly what he's saying. He says nutrition and infectious diseases, and then he says displacements and conflicts.
Yeah.
I don't see.
Well, enough crop failures in Africa, then for example, and there's already some evidence of this happening. You know, people are going to up and move to areas where if they haven't got any food where they're living, then they have to try to go somewhere where there is food.
Yes, yes.
So yeah, that stands to reason. I mean, one of the other things that. To some extent, people kind of sees this as an opportunity for a bit of breastfeeding, don't they?
It's a
question of practicalities.
Yes.
It's all very well to say, it's terrible and it's going to have an effect on the health of the global population, it is terrible, and it will have an effect on the health of the global population. But the question is, what can you do about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I must say, I do wonder, and I don't really know the answer to this, I wonder how much the pharmaceuticals industry is based on a chemicals industry, which is environmentally unfriendly. How unfriendly is the pharmaceuticals industry? How much of it relies on oil products, for example, to create pharmaceuticals? I suspect that there are links there, but I don't really know.
Well, there's lots of paraffin in emollients.
Yeah, well, there you go.
That's what sets children on fire, isn't it? And makes them fall over in the bath. I don't know the answer to that question either, but I think that's an interesting that's an interesting thing to think about. Anyway, he's saying that there's, you know, the panel on climate change saying that we're going to be 1.5 centigrade warmer by 2040.
Yeah.
So
they're trying to limit it to less than 2%, aren't they? And they're trying to
cut down the CO2.
Yeah, they're trying to get CO2 emissions down to pre-industrial levels by 2050 is what they were saying.
Yes, that's right.
Initially.
Yes, yes, net zero by 2050. You're right. Yeah. Yes. And then there are other agencies involved, something about biodiversity and ecosystem services, and the effect on the biosphere, including pollution, and alien species.
Yes.
It probably means Martians, doesn't it?
Probably, yeah.
Yes. and then something about... incentives and decision making, resilience, and implementing things with laws.
Yes.
But how effective that's going to be is difficult to judge, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he references in there this RCGP toolkit.
Yes. Yeah.
I say he. I'm not sure if this was written by one person.
Yes, I think so.
There's an RCGP toolkit, which is designed for recommending how people in primary care could actually do things.
Yes.
To help with the environmental crisis.
Yes.
And I went and had a look at the RCGP toolkit.
Yeah.
You haven't looked at it,
no,
have you?
No, I haven't.
It's got all these different levels in it. You can have, you know, sort of bronze compliance or silver compliance or gold compliance.
Yes.
And I only got as far as the bronze compliance, but that was kind of divided up into about 100 different... Well, it wasn't 100 different. It was about 8 different sections, I think, each of which had, you know, a number of different things. It. Right. So it was a bit like CQC, you know, you look at it and you think, Christ,
lose the
words. So you know, I think what you need to do is kind of look for quick wins.
Yes, yes.
So the quick win that we got out of it was this recommendation that's in this toolkit that instead of using Google when you're searching for things on the web, you should use this site called Ecosia.
Yes.
Because they use their the revenue they generate from advertising to fund reforestation.
Yeah.
So that's what we've done in the surgery. We've gone around and we've put Ecosia as the default browser on everybody's the default search engine on everybody's web browser.
So it planted trees all over the car park.
Yes, that's right. You can't get out the front door anymore. So that's not. I mean, it's nice. It makes you feel as if you're doing something just by opening up your web browser and searching for, you know, the BMJ or whatever you might search for. And we're always searching for things online.
Yes, definitely.
And it actually, have you noticed this? It gives you a little count up here of how many web searches you've done.
Right.
Once you get up to 24, you've done 16.
Yes.
Once you get up to 24, you've planted a tree, apparently.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
So that's quite nice, really.
Yeah.
But there are other... I've made a little list of other sort of reasonably quick wins.
Yeah.
There's and the other one that was at the top of my list was there's a scheme called the Complete the Cycle Inhaler Scheme.
Yes, I remember you saying that. Yeah.
And apparently what this does is if your local pharmacist is in the Complete the Cycle scheme, and it just goes to show how, you know, I haven't got round to checking this yet,
even though
I read this about 3 weeks ago.
Yes,
shows how busy you are. You just can't get around to doing this stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, if your local pharmacist is in the scheme, then once people have exhausted their plastic inhalers, they take them back to the pharmacy and they can recycle them instead of them just being chucked away. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
They mention about promoting exercise and well-being and reducing pharmacy.
Yes.
And so the general philosophy is, you know, don't don't medicalise things because, you know, tablets and things are the whole process of producing them, packaging them, is environmentally unfriendly. Yeah. And the less medication you can get away with using, the better from the environmental point of view.
Yeah.
And then DNARs to reduce hospital admissions. I mean, we haven't really been tremendously proactive in making sure that all of our sort of elderly patients or patients on the palliative care register have got DNARs in place.
Yeah, but some of the problem with that is you don't get letters from the hospital very quickly nowadays, do you?
It could that's true.
It could be, you know, 4 or 8 weeks before you get a letter saying this patient didn't turn up.
Having a DNA, do not attempt resuscitation statement, I'm talking about.
All right, sorry.
But having one of those in place doesn't necessarily prevent people from going to hospital automatically.
No, it doesn't, you're right, yeah.
But that, you know, I suppose the idea is if people have decided they don't want to be resuscitated, then what's the point of sticking them in an ambulance and whisking them off to the hospital every 5 minutes? So that there is a potential bit of saving there. But the thing that I'm personally invested in, which isn't in the RCGP toolkit, is this business of, you know, single use recyclable speculums that we were looking into. And there's a company in Holland called Bridea, I think they're called, and they produce an orchid speculum, which is a vegetable-based plastic and you know, much more environmentally friendly. It's also considerably more expensive than the ones that we're using at the moment. I mean, first of all, I suppose we should say that looking into it, the single-use disposable speculums might not seem to be more environmentally friendly than the old-fashioned metal speculums that you can clean and reuse.
Yes, yes.
On the face of it, perhaps we ought to go back to metal reusable speculums. But in fact,
you'd have to send them off to be sterilised properly.
And the sterilisation process is quite environmentally unfriendly.
Right.
Requires high temperatures and detergents and things.
Yes.
And as you say, you have to package them up to send them off. Yeah. You have to drive them away somewhere. You have to drive them back again, repackaged.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is evidently, when it's been audited, it turns out that the single-use ones are actually more environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
But if you could get single-use ones that were made out of more environmentally friendly plastics, that would make a big difference.
Yeah, definitely.
On top of that. And you know, the NHS, we are wedded to single-use plastics. All the sort of blood-taking, smear-taking, all of that kind of thing. There's lots of single-use plastics involved. And if we could start to make some kind of impression on that, then it would be a big change, and it would actually make a massive difference to things like landfill and energy consumption and so on and so forth.
Exactly. And if there's lots of spare money left in the PCN account in January, then maybe we could spend it on that.
So that would be nice. I mean, it's a bit of a pipe dream, but I did pass all this on to the Federation. Yes, they're supposed to be looking into it. So we'll wait and see what happens about that.
Well, one of the other things we've done in the surgery is that coffee machine as well.
Yes.
to save the world, basically.
Well, that's true,
yes.
The water heating machine.
Yes.
So for the benefit of the listeners, I suppose we should explain. We suddenly got a massively expensive... We get our energy from good energy, so that's quite environmentally friendly, I suppose, to start with. But we suddenly got a massively expensive electricity bill because we'd used so much electricity that it had gone up into the 20% VAT.
Yeah.
It had crossed a threshold and gone up into the 20% VAT category instead of whatever it was before, 7 point something or something. So we thought, why are we using so much electricity? And when we sort of thought about it, the reason was because we drink coffee
all day long
and tea all day long, and we keep reboiling the kettle over and over again.
Yeah, so some of the cups are not drunk, they just sit
around. So we got this water heater that just heats the water that you use for your coffee, and immediately our electricity bill plummeted and we went back into the lower VAT category again. And it saved us. Well, it seems to have saved
pounds,
us. Well, it certainly has saved us quite a lot of money, but it's also saved a lot of energy.
Yeah,
so
that's true. Yeah, Yes.
So it just goes to show.
Yeah.
You don't even think about that until...
No, no, exactly. Well, one of the other things from this article is about the NHS travel and how much, what percentage of road travel is, road miles in England are due to trips to hospital, either from patients, you know, going to hospital or people visiting them in hospital.
Yeah.
And it's 3.5% of road miles in England per year.
Really?
Yeah, and it's up, you know, well, and 50% of that is patients and visitors.
Yeah.
I suppose the rest must be doctors and nurses, is it?
Well, I suppose, yes, completely.
Cleaners. Okay.
So, yeah, so I suppose that's an argument in favour of all this trying to...
yeah.
You know, relocate services in the community as well.
Yes,
much
that's
as
what they're saying. It, yeah, get the care closer to the people, rather. And this is a word he uses: it rather than the dirtier care that you get in secondary care and tertiary care. I think it used to be high up in the RCGP. Yeah, but anyway, so that's that. And then at the end he says, well...
But what about home visits for GPs? What about that?
Well, I think you should go on your bike, really.
I suppose if GPs' home visits were taken over by, you know,
yes,
an agency,
yeah,
which has just been mooted on a number of occasions,
yeah,
that might be a more efficient way of doing it, sooner than each GP having his own car and driving round.
Yes,
you know,
yeah, it's quite possible, isn't
and
it?
And maybe
yes,
you go and visit somebody in the Frith Estate.
Yes, and somebody
else
needs
today,
to
and then a different GP
yeah,
goes and visits
yeah, exactly,
the person next door
yeah,
in a different vehicle.
Yes.
So you can imagine there could be a saving there.
Yes. I think we're almost done on this, but there's something about telling patients... Oh, being GPs as role models and educators to people... telling them to watch their diet, don't eat meat because meat uses up a lot of energy
yes,
in growing it. Just eat vegetables, then you save 70% of the energy.
Well, eat insects.
Yes, eat insects.
Because that's all that's going to be left in a few years' time.
Definitely lose weight of the insects because they're so horrible.
And they're so difficult to catch as well.
Yes, that's right. So you get the exercise and...
To chase them around the house.
Lose weight and... You do eat them, you see.
We'll be laughing outside of our faces when we actually do have to eat insects and chase them around the house.
Yes. Okay, so is that enough for that one?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
I mean, it is a question of, you know, you have to find things that you can do practically, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And try not to be overwhelmed by the kind of... the kind of angst of it all, you know,
yes,
the world's
yeah,
coming to an end. Yeah. There's nothing we can do about it.
No, no.
You have to try to be practical. And,
yes,
you know.
Yes, lucky there aren't any polar bears around here.
No, you don't see many of them around here, do you?
Okay,
so that's that one.
Yeah. What
so,
do you want to do next?
Well, should we do the spirituality?
Yes, we can do. Yeah.
So this is another one from the same edition of the BJGP, the November 2019 edition, and it's called Spiritual Needs Assessment, the Loads Shared Mnemonic.
Yes, yes.
So, do you want to...
Well, the idea of the article is that spiritual well-being is linked to physical well-being. They don't necessarily mean religion by that, but they mean, you know, seeking a meaning in your life and the world.
Yeah.
So, and apparently most GPs...
Is that
know
what they mean? Do they actually define what they mean
they
by spirituality?
It in there. Yes, it's something that's about looking for meaning. It helps patients address inner needs and find meaning or transcendence. And then he talks about the... you know, the sort of that triangle, Maslow's hierarchy, where at the bottom of it all is physiological needs, and at the top of the triangle is transcendence or, you know, spiritual need or fulfillment, whatever you want to call it, really.
Yes.
You're not convinced, are you, really, by this?
Well, I think therein lies the problem, but we'll
yeah,
come to that in a minute.
Yes,
so,
okay,
yeah, carry on.
Okay. And then he sort of goes on to say that... The one way that this has been assessed previously is with questionnaires, And there are, apparently, and I've never heard of them, community chaplaincy listening services and primary care chaplaincy. But I don't think they're in this area that I know of at all. But some of them, the questionnaires are, like a lot of questionnaires, they're just looking at how people, what people's views are and, you know, how they affect medical care. Whereas this this loads shared one, I'll tell you what that means in a minute.
Yes.
Is about what goes on in a normal consultation. I nearly said constipation. So it's how people respond in the consultation. You know, cues that you pick up on, themes, and they're wanting to tell you, you know, their stories.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. So that they're saying that it's more in keeping with normal general practice. So yes. You pick up on things instead of saying, right, I'm going to, I think you'd have spiritual needs, so I'm going to get you to fill in this questionnaire.
Yes.
So, and so, then there's somebody else, some other bloke called Hanlon, who talks about modern maladies. And so he says that the modern maladies are things like loss and well-being, obesity, addiction.
Loss of well-being, yeah.
Yeah.
Obesity, addictive behaviours.
Yes, depression, anxiety, yeah. Social isolation, consumerism, individualism. I'm not quite sure what that means, because we are individuals.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
I'm an automaton.
You're right, okay. And sort of, and the how we retreat, you know, with all this modern maladies, we, you know, retreat from the external world and become more cut off. so the, but the, do you want me to tell you about the load shares, or do you want to read that lot out?
No, you tell me about
it. Okay, all right.
I'm too lazy to read that out.
Okay. So it's loss of well-being, like you say, but there's other loss in there as well, like, you know, bereavement.
So this is what, the loads
bit is L for loss, O for obesity, A for addiction, D for depression and anxiety. But I don't think you spell D with anxiety with a D.
With a depression.
No. Social isolation. So those are some of those things. And then on the other side, the shared bit is shame and guilt, which quite often I think guilt is not something that deserves to be there. It's just a very negative feeling that people end up with, and they might not be guilty of doing anything.
Right.
And sometimes it's people who have been, you know, been through terrible experiences
and feel guilty.
Yeah, they feel guilty,
even though it's not their fault.
Yes, exactly.
But what do you? So that's the S of shared.
Health and losses of health, good health.
Yeah.
And then appearance, which I think is about.
So that's the A.
Yes. Losses of, you know...
How ugly you are.
Yes. That's how you
think. And you feel ashamed and guilty about how ugly you are. I get that a lot, actually. Yeah. And then relationships, of course. Yes. You can't have good relationships because you're so ugly. so ashamed and guilty.
Yeah, and the next one on the list of shared is the E, which is employment. Of course, you can't get employed.
Because you're so ugly and haven't got any good relationships.
Yes. And then the final one is death and bereavement.
Right.
So you can't be bereaved if you're dead yourself, I don't suppose.
No.
But, you know, it does make sense in a way.
So have you actually, I can see, it kind of makes sense, but have you actually used this? I bet you haven't.
No, I haven't used it, but it fits in with a lot of the stuff about the modern malady, really, that this... You know, we do get, and I think part of that is the you know, social media.
Yes.
How you're not in the real world.
Yeah.
You're in this world, this technical world. You're not having real human contact, and I think it's lack of that real human contact that makes people more and more isolated and less meaning in their lives.
Well, I suppose you're thinking of adolescence in particular when you say that.
Yeah.
Yes and no.
Yes. What's the no bit then?
Well, in some ways, online, social media, etc.
Yes.
Can be very enabling.
Yes, yeah.
It can actually break down isolation in some instances. Yeah. So I suppose that would be the no. I mean, my experience of it has been quite enabling, really.
Yes,
you know, becoming members of these kind of online groups and things and getting to know people who I would never have got to know if it hadn't been for the online.
No, you're right. It's
not so much social media, because that's probably my sort of experiences of online community sort of predate social media to a large extent.
Yes.
You know, Facebook and things like that weren't around when I started joining these discussion groups and things.
Yes.
But I mean, what we're doing now, this podcast, is an online social media thing.
Yes, but
and of course, we're spreading enormous amounts of well-being amongst the community by doing this.
As far as I know, at least one of us in the room is human. So I think there is a bit of human contact there. Anyway, he goes on to say, enables growth of what nourishes human life and spirit.
Yeah.
But it is about, you know, some of it is about finding a meaning in life as well.
Yeah.
That we all search that sort of thing. I don't know if we do really, but you know.
Well, it begs a lot of questions, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, one of the questions that it begs is that this loads shared mnemonic.
Yes.
The fact that you've got these two words, loads and shared, implies that the loads are the kind of things that are dragging you down.
Yes.
And then the shared
are
the kind of things that by kind of linking with other people, you're going to find the strength to deal with these loads.
But in fact, you've got
downers on the loads list, and you've got downers on the shared list as well. So, and I suspect that this mnemonic scheme would be actually quite difficult to carry through.
Yes, I think it would.
Into a consultation with a given person.
Yes, I think the good thing about it is this. You know, it's what GPs do, and we listen to people.
Yes.
So
it's a way of highlighting that.
You might say, well, actually, if there was such a thing as community chaplaincy listening or something like that, that might be helpful.
Might be helpful, yeah. But also, I mean, the kind of... there are bits in this article where he talks about being able to... people will still be able to have their spiritual needs assessed. Yeah. Even if they say, I haven't got any spiritual needs, and they don't believe in spirituality,
no.
They've got spiritual needs, whether they think they have or not, and they're going to have those needs assessed. So it's a bit the opposite of patient-centered care, in a way, isn't it? It doesn't matter what you think, you've got spirituality, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, and once it gets into quaff, everyone will be having it done.
And spirituality is, you know, it's quite a loaded term, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's not psychological well-being, or it's not just that.
No.
It's got this kind of implicit assumption that everybody has got like a spiritual life.
Yes.
And that spiritual life, you know, the implication, the phrase transcendent.
Yes.
Has, again, is a loaded term. It implies that there's stuff beyond the physical.
Exactly. You're
and
right.
It's all about your kind of, you know, your sort of, you know, your spirit life, I suppose.
Yes. But
I suppose the next step to that is that it kind of implies that you've got an immortal spirit which isn't tied to your body.
Well, that's
it doesn't spell
that
out. That
goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, or even thousands. That idea.
So there's that kind of implication there, and I think that's what people might possibly find a bit sort of intrusive. And a bit of an imposition.
Well, I think there is a big overlap with, you know, spiritual and what people think of as religious as well.
So if
there?
You were a real dyed-in-the-wool atheist,
I
think you might actually think this was coming at a bit.
That's true. But it also links into sort of philosophy as well, you know. And in philosophy there is about, you know, mind, you know, rather than a soul and, you know, things like that. So,
well, that's the difference, isn't it? Spirituality implies that you're talking about somebody's soul as opposed to psychology, which is talking about somebody's mind or well-being, which is talking about people's minds and emotions.
Yes, exactly. So, the well-being is a, you know, important part of this, I think.
Yeah.
There's a clear link there with well-being and being well.
Well, yes.
I guess. we're taking a fair bit of time.
Oh, well, we've taken half an hour just discussing two.
Right, okay.
Two articles.
So we better hurry up.
So we won't say anything at all about any of the other articles. Right. We'll just mention their titles and then that'll be enough.
Okay,
so the next one was ectopic pregnancy.
Yes.
So let's see if I can find that. So ectopic pregnancy is an article which I have lost.
Well, I can remember little bits about it.
Yeah,
I think it was something about how the scanning now has got we're doing ultrasound scans early, you know, with possible miscarriage or could be an ectopic. There are more clear signs of, you know, knowing that there could be an ectopic.
Yeah, here we are.
But it was very, very, it was very complex.
Hang on, let's do this properly. Let's do the title. So this is from the BMJ, this one. And it's Ectopic Pregnancy and Miscarriage, Diagnosis and Initial Management, Summary of Updated NICE Guidance. And this was, and they've got these funny references, haven't they? And this is L6283. That's the BMJ reference for this article. Yeah, and I think the what they're saying is that basically you can monitor.
Yes, that's true.
In primary care.
Well, I think probably monitor. Connected to secondary care at the same time. So with people, I mean, there's a big bit about what you see on an ultrasound, but I don't think we need to talk about that really. But they are saying that the options
because that
are,
will be interpreted in secondary care.
You can be medically managed if you had an ectopic, so using methotrexate, and or surgically managed subinjectomy.
So this is a tubal ectopic pregnancy. Which presumably is you establish via the ultrasound process whether it's tubal or not.
That's right.
And if it is tubal, then you can do this expectant management, as they call it.
Yeah, so because it might, you know, you might get away without the methotrexate and you might get away without surgery as well. But it's linked to monitoring of HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, and if the levels are low and the size of the possible ectopic on the ultrasound is below a certain level, then it can be safe to monitor as long as the person is able to get to the hospital.
Right.
So that was really the gist of it. It's just another way of dealing with ectopics.
And what's the guidelines for how often the HCG levels should be checked? Down there?
Day 2, day 4, day 7 after the original test. But it depends on whether it's dropping or if it's rising and things like that.
Right, okay.
Then you might have to do more or less frequent tests. So
a bit like DMARD monitoring. If it starts to wobble all over the place, then you have to do them more frequently.
But they're saying that it's all based on limited evidence, you know, but there's no definite higher rates in the two options of either the methotrexate or the expectant management.
I don't really understand where methotrexate comes into it, because you don't really think of methotrexate as being.
I guess it ends the pregnancy.
So it sort of precipitates a miscarriage, or.
Well, I think it just ends the living thing that's there.
Right.
So presumably that means it doesn't get any bigger and doesn't rupture the tube.
And if you don't do that, does this then lead to a normal birth eventually?
If it's in the tube, no.
No.
You'd get the ruptured ectopic.
So what is the eventual outcome then?
Well,
you'd
be very, very ill and you could have...
No, if you're monitoring it and it seems to be okay, then what's the eventual outcome
then? If it looks like it's shrinking, then it will just could just disappear.
Of its own accord?
Yeah, well, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're not going to have you're not going to have a birth at the end of a tubal pregnancy, but you don't necessarily have to have methotrexate or a surgical intervention is what they're saying.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's that one.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's quite interesting. So if people want to know then about the precisely how they do the HCG monitoring, they'll have to consult the NICE guideline.
Yeah.
Okay, so and then we were going to do emollients.
Yes.
Called which emollients are effective and acceptable for eczema in children. And again, this is from the BMJ.
Yeah.
And the reference for this one is L5882. So... And this is basically saying nobody knows which emollients.
Yes, that's true, yeah. There's no evidence that one is better than another, but they're suggesting that you should give lots of emollients to the mother of the child.
Yes.
So she can try different ones out and see which ones seem to work better. So I'm not sure what the CCG would say about that.
No.
And then it says things, lotions are the lightest, creams are a bit thicker, gels are thicker still, and ointments are very thick, and just used for severe eczema. But they say don't use ones that have also got either urea or antimicrobials on at first, because they can cause irritation. And then
there was some stuff that you didn't know about before, about applying...
Yeah, this bit here. Well, firstly, stroking it downwards. Don't rub it in. Stroke downwards against the normal...
In the same direction that
your hairs grow. Yes,
not against the grain,
yes,
as it were.
Yeah, because otherwise it can lead to irritation of the skin and folliculitis, that sort of thing. But the thing I didn't know anything about was, when you're putting someone on a... emollient and a steroid.
Yes, the timing.
Yeah, it's the timing. I thought maybe you'd have to give them completely different times of the day. But apparently it's all right if you've got 60 minutes in between each one, because the one doesn't then dilute the other. I'm not quite sure how they know that or how it works, but anyway, it's what they've said. So anyway, they said formularies, from all around the country have conflicting regulations, so... It's difficult to know.
Just go with your local formula, and it probably won't. It won't be any better or worse than any other local formula.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've set this thing up on EMIS now, which I meant to tell you about. I've actually got that set up now, so it will do as a little protocol that you can trigger that will do a prescription for a selection of four emollients.
Yes.
So like 100 grams of each.
Yeah.
So that you can just, instead of actually having to write them in on your keyboard, you just trigger this protocol. It does the prescription of all four of them.
Yes.
You just give it to the mum and say, here you go,
try
these four, see which one you like the best kind of thing.
And they say
you did like a gel, an ointment.
Yeah.
I can't remember what they were. But
And a lotion, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I think they can also do one thing on one limb and one on the other, so they can see which one seems to work better for them as well. What else did we find out about this? It says stinging with emollients might mean a steroid cream is needed.
Right.
So, and pots. If you get a pot of cream or...
Oh, yes, it's reservoir.
It could be an
infection
reservoir. Yes, so then you can use a spoon to get it out.
Yes.
And then the spoon is a reservoir.
And if you have a tube and put your finger on the end of it repeatedly, then that becomes a reservoir.
And all of a sudden your house is contaminated by bacteria.
Yes.
So there we go. That's that one.
Well, that's quite interesting. I mean, that's actually got some sort of nice practical tips about emollients.
Yeah,
so that's and then we had an article about sepsis.
Yes.
Now this one is called David Oliver, Sepsis, What's Behind the Hype? Another BMJ one, and this is L6327. And we had one of our educational meetings a few weeks ago, didn't we? And I think it was Tim Winch, who's one of the GPs, that comes along and was saying, I think he'd been to a meeting with a consultant who was saying how many people actually die of sepsis.
Yes, yes.
And
it's much less than
people might suppose.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult to actually pin down deaths to sepsis if you actually analyse them carefully.
Yeah.
So
Well, one of the things this article is, this was a letter in The Lancet, I think, by a lot of people who know a lot about sepsis or about serious illnesses in hospital.
And this guy, David Oliver, who was writing in the BMJ, was basically picking up on that letter and saying it's quite important because quite a lot of the people who wrote the letter were involved in formulating the new sepsis guidelines in the first place. So
that's interesting.
The authors were recognised experts in sepsis deterioration and scores for identifying physiological decline.
Yeah.
Mervyn Singer has been a key player in international consensus definitions of sepsis and an advocate for improving care. And he goes on about the other ones as well.
Yes, yeah. What they're saying about the deaths is that most of the deaths are in old, frail, multi-morbid patients, and their death is not likely to be preventable.
Yeah.
But because it's become such a buzzword, then people think, oh, you should have got them started on,
sepsis treatment. Yeah, you should have recognised the sepsis.
Yes. And then you follow the guidelines, but there's no good. Apparently, there's poor evidence for the tools and protocols as well.
Mm.
But there's always the fear and anger regarding missed sepsis.
Yes.
So that's really, that's the main gist of that one, isn't
it? Well, yeah, I think it's, yes, I mean, it's kind of it's kind of arguing that because we're using all these kind of sepsis detection and sepsis prevention algorithms, we're kind of over-identifying to some extent.
Yes, that's true.
As you say, there may be people dying, even people who die of sepsis, that doesn't necessarily mean that you could prevent the death.
Yes, or even if that was the correct diagnosis.
Yeah.
But then there's one of my favourite things about, the protocols, might not enhance diagnosis, but relying and help make people rely less on diagnostic acumen. So,
yes.
Gut feelings.
So never trust any kind of formal protocol or analysis. Just go by what you feel.
Follow your emotions.
Yes. And that's bound to be right.
Everything will be all right until you get struck off.
It's all spiritual.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, so that's that one.
Okay,
now we're going to finish off.
Yeah.
About Amazon. Government hands Amazon free access to NHS information. Mm. Another article from the BMJ, L6901 is the reference. And they're saying, I quote, Amazon has been given access to all healthcare information of the NHS in England except patients' records. Apparently there's been a freedom of information request about a government contract with Amazon, and that's the upshot of it. And I think Matt Hancock Amazon argue that all of this information is freely available on the web already, and B, Matt Hancock says that if Amazon have this information, then it means that you can talk to what's their thing called that you say?
The one Elise or something like that.
Yes.
Elsie.
Alexa.
Alexa.
The Alexa service. Yeah. He says that people could get NHS health information and advice through the voice-activated Alexa service. I mean, when they say at the beginning of this article that they've been given, Amazon have been given access to all healthcare information, you think, well, what are they, other than personal records, what information does this mean? Does it mean about health populations, hospital attendances, diagnostic rates, or what?
Yes.
The reference to Alexa seems to imply that actually what, I mean, that particular bit seems to be to do with having access to NHS guidance and information.
Yeah.
So if people ask,
Alexa,
should I have antibiotics for my sore throat?
Yes,
then Alexa will say, no, you don't need antibiotics for your sore throat. Your sore throat will get better of its own accord.
Alexa, I can't breathe and I can't swallow.
Alexa, I've got sepsis. Correct, you have got sepsis. So there's that. The thing is that this kind of plays into this debate that was happening during the general election campaign about whether or not Donald Trump was going to be sold the NHS by Boris Johnson. And to a large extent, I think that debate was kind of different understandings of what was meant by selling the NHS.
Yes,
So Boris Johnson, of course, was going, no, of course we're not going to sell the NHS to the USA, meaning we're not going to let them come over here and run all the hospitals sell off, you know, big chunks of NHS healthcare provision to the USA. But things like this kind of Amazon having access to healthcare advice and putting it through their devices is kind of a bit of the tip of the iceberg of what could actually happen.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the debate during the election seemed to focus on pharmaceutical prices.
Yes.
But I suspect that this kind of technological enablement and that going through big multinational companies is probably going to be just as much the playing field where this kind of thing's going to happen.
Yes, I think you're right there.
And and Amazon are already, as I was saying to you earlier, they're already becoming quite big players in the healthcare field. So we've got a document management system called DocMan.
Yes.
And about 4 months ago, DocMan said that they were going to shift all of the documents that are processed through DocMan are now in the cloud.
Yes.
As opposed to on a physical server in your physical GP surgery, they're out there in the cloud somewhere.
Yeah.
And the bit of the cloud that they're in is a server provision owned by Amazon. Right. Amazon have got this big kind of cloud, databasing warehouse type thing out there somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's what DocMan are now using for all of these clinical letters and things are basically reliant on Amazon. Amazon are also getting into being providers of pharmaceutical delivery systems. They've kind of expressed an interest in doing what Pharmacy 2U do.
Yes,
starting to set that up as an Amazon service. A guy from Australia who replied to this article in the BMJ mentioned the fact that they're in partnership with Cerner, who provide the electronic patient records to loads of hospitals all over the NHS.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can see that they're gradually sort of piecemeal acquiring a bit of sort of technological real estate in the NHS. And once they start to stitch this all together, they're going to be a massive player.
Yeah.
What they do, of course, is Amazon use algorithms to stitch together this kind of information that they've acquired from different sources.
Yes.
And they can use it to then target their services more effectively. Yeah. That's what they do via the Amazon website.
Yes. Yeah.
And they'll be able to do the same thing via health. So if you said, Amazon, you know, what do I do about my sore throat?
Yes.
Amazon, let's imagine Amazon have got their own brand cough mixture.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
They can then leverage that to you because of you making that inquiry. Yeah. So, you know, you can imagine that a lot of this kind of, technological information gathering can become a big sort of commercial driver within the healthcare, within healthcare provision.
Yes.
And it is a little bit disturbing, really, that...
But what about the confidentiality bit of it, then? What about this cloud full of people's information?
Well, it's all supposed to be encrypted. Right. It's all supposed to be confidential.
Right.
But I think the question about that would be similar to the question about... can you remember that initiative there was where everybody
share your information?
Yeah, the information was going to be sucked out of GP practices put in a big silo, and people sort of, as it were, bid for. And it was all meant to be, I can't remember what it's called now. It's called I something or other. But anyway, it was it was called Care Data, wasn't it? Care Data Initiative, run by NHS England.
Yeah.
And it was basically, we'll take lots of masses of anonymised data,
and
we'll stick it all in a great big silo, and then companies can bid to have access to that data, and it could be very useful for research purposes. But of course, it can also be very useful for health insurance company purposes.
Yes, absolutely.
This was what it eventually founded on, because people realised that if you had a rare condition, and a health insurance company, got the anonymised data for that rare health condition in your area, they could they would soon be able to work out that it get it down to a specific person or a very small group of people.
Yes.
So the data may be anonymised, but if you've got powerful enough analysis of that data, you can probably actually tie it down to specific people or specific areas or specific customer groups or whatever. Yeah. So how helpful the anonymity is.
Yeah.
It's like Facebook targeting ads at people and persuading them to vote in certain ways, which seems to have been the case.
Yeah.
It may not be targeting individual people, but it's as good as, because of the way the algorithms work send you the information that you're particularly vulnerable to.
Yeah.
So it's going to be the same thing in health, I think.
Yeah.
So we're all doomed.
Yes, exactly. On that note.
Yes, okay. Well, I think
that
pretty much ties it up for podcast number two.
Well,
hope you enjoyed it.
Yes.
We'll be back next month.
You can all wake up now.
Yes. Okay. okay, so let's tap into that. Switch that off.